I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear John, KC2WGV. John and Dick attempt after all these years to organize this enthusiastic crowd that meets most evenings, most Sunday evenings on the technical net. The technical net gathers amateur radio operators who have got questions about how all this hardware works, and we try to help each other, educate each other on how that works. If there's enough time later on, we'll probably get into a little bit more of a discussion about suggestions for improving firearm safety. But the main subject I think we'll be discussing tonight, as usual, will be ham radio subjects. The usual plan of action is that we take questions. Let me drop. People sign in giving John and Dick your call letters, then your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. We take them in the order in which they sign in. During the first hour, we make a serious attempt to at least give a brief answer to everybody's question during that first hour, from 8 to 9, roughly, plus or minus a little bit. At the end of that hour, Paul, WS2N, gives us a space report, tells us a little bit about what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. After that, we get into other subjects, sometimes deeper subjects, and maybe that will be the time in which we'll have a further discussion on gun safety. That was a subject that we opened up at the tail end of the TechNet last Sunday night, and it got pretty enthusiastic. Some pretty good suggestions got sent back and forth, and so it's an extremely difficult problem. I know darn well that Joe Biden and Barack Obama are going to have a pretty tough time coming up with a plan of action that anyone will accept as a glamour fix. There is no glamour fix. We're going to have to accept very partial fixes, and maybe a whole lot of them, in order to get better control of that situation. That's an opinion. Okay, give me your call letters and name right now if you're signing in with a question or a comment. K2LIW listening.
K2MDP, Steven, yes.
V2YY, Joe, yes.
W-A-2-R-Y-Y, Joe, yes.
Okay, we've got Steve and Joe. Anyone else assigning? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
V-B-2-V-B-N, Far Rockaway, Freddy.
Okay, Far Rockaway, give it to me a little bit slower. Sound like W-B-2 blank blank blank. And the name, you're going to have to give that to me slower. So, Far Rockaway, give me your call letters phonetically and name slowly. Go right ahead.
Victor, Bravo, November,
SETI. Okay, I got Victor, Bravo, November. But it sounds like you said SETI, S-E-T-T-Y, and I can't believe that. Give me your handle phonetically, Victor, Bravo, November. Go ahead. Victor, Bravo, November. Please tell me your handle one more time.
I think you said Freddy.
Okay. Write it down as Freddy, and I can look him up. So, okay, we've got Steve, Joe, Freddy. Steve, Joe, and Freddy. Anyone else assigning? Give me your call letters and name right now.
N2LDY with a question.
Okay, we've got N2LDY. Let me write that one down. And I think that's Dave, is that true? Say that again, John.
Don, D-O-N.
Okay, we got Don, Freddy, Joe, and Steve in reverse order. One last call. Anyone else to sign in with a question or a comment? Call letters and name, please, right now.
It is to Charlie, Yankee Zulu, no question.
Okay, Charlie, Yankee Zulu with a no. Alrighty, Steve, K2MDP. Is it K2MDP? Correct me on that one, Steve. Go right ahead with your question. K2LAW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, Dick, you got it right. Mike Delta Papa, KC2 Mike Delta Papa. First of all, I'd like to start off wishing you and everyone else on the net the very best of happiness this holiday season. And, Dick, I got a question, basically simple. It's right up your alley. I know you've been there. I recently acquired some hardline, you know, from the cable company. I got those Stinger connectors. I was curious, how did you adapt those to UHF, and did you ever try adapting them to Type N connectors? That's it, in a nutshell. Back to you.
Yeah, very fine, Steve. Stand by a minute while we get a beep. And by the way, if you guys, when there's a gap in between, if you wait for all four beeps and then 1 or 2 seconds beyond that, our Canadian friends and other people who sign in from further away with Echo Link or IRLP say very nice, pleasant things about us if we give enough time, 1 or 2 seconds after the beep, to make sure that everything gets reset and therefore they don't get timed out and don't get left in the dark. Okay, the Stinger connectors, the ones that I used were made for 3/4 inch hardline, which was popular in the day when I started using hardline. You're listening to a piece of hardline right now, 3/4 inch 70 ohm hardline of my 100 foot tower is what I've been using for years and years. And it's got a Stinger connector on each end. The Stinger connector is made to directly mate with the hardline. It gives you essentially hermetic seal, and it's a kind of a collet mechanism that grabs onto the outer conductor of the hardline very securely. It does a good job of connecting to the center conductor. To properly install the hardline connector, let me drop. To properly install the hardline connector, if you're a purist, I guess I sort of was, you buy the coring tool, a tool that will core out, it will carefully cut out just the right amount of the foam dielectric or insulation that's between the center conductor and the outer conductor. A skilled guy taking some time can definitely do it with a Swiss Army knife, but if you want to do it a little bit more rapidly, a little bit more neatly, you buy the coring tool. How neatly you whittle out the foam in order to properly install the connector really is an extremely minor factor, Steve, because the foam itself has got a very low dielectric constant. It's not that far away from air. So if you leave a little bit too much foam or take away a little too much foam, the perturbation impedance is very small. The connector itself is 70 ohm. The cable is 70 ohm. They call it a Stinger connector because it's got a very long center conductor, and it's got an outer thread that normally screws into the box that contains the amplifiers, the amplifiers that are a part of the cable TV system. A cable TV system requires something like 14 amplifiers per mile to keep boosting up that signal as it keeps getting lossy, particularly at the higher frequencies going down that cable, all of those individual cable channels. So this connector is made to screw down to the box. It's got a 5/8 24 thread on the outside. You screw that into the box, and then this long Stinger connector picks up the printed circuit board inside, and there's a sort of a set screw that you tighten when you install it in that way. When you and I are going to put a connector on the end of the Stinger, the easiest connector to put there is most, but not all, of the brands of UHF 21, Type N male connector. You take a Type N male connector, you remove the nut from the back, which happens to be the
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
The nut on the back, which is the thing that squeezes down on the piece of rubber normally when you are putting it on a piece of RG8 cable, RG214, RG213, that nut has got a washer, it squeezes down on a piece of rubber, and you put that on first before you flip that on first before you start putting the connector, the coaxial cable inside of the connector where you've properly combed it out and done all that work with the braid. So, you remove that nut on the back of the UG21 and do not use it. The UG21, the back of it, the Type N connector, just happens to 5/8-24. The 5/8-24 will mate directly with the outer thread on the Stinger connector. There's a rubber washer that they put there, which normally goes between the connector and the box. You leave that rubber washer there, and now you're not going to tighten down that connector all the way. You're just going to tighten it enough to squeeze on that rubber washer so that the back of your UG21 is sealed. And it can do a real good job. You put some silicone grease on that rubber washer. Now the center conductor, the Stinger, has got a center conductor that sticks out way too far. You're going to carefully cut off the Stinger at just the right length so that when you solder the male pin onto it, the male pin will now protrude from the front end of the type N connector just the right amount. You'll notice that the stinger connector, its long center rod coming out of it, is a little bit smaller in diameter than the inner diameter of the male pin that you're going to solder on. But that's a minor problem. The inner dimensions of the stinger connector, let me drop, are 70 ohm. Your UG21 connector, your type N connector, is, in theory, 50 ohms. So during the length of the connector, which is about an inch or so, there's going to be a piece of 70 ohm cable, inch or so long, at the a piece of 70 ohm cable at the end of your 50 ohm antenna, we'll say, and then that in turn goes into the 70 ohm hard line. So it's a good impedance match, at least to 432. I've used it at 2.4 gigs, and the amount of standing wave ratio you get from that connector with a slightly hokey method of hooking it up is reasonably good. Now, in the case of putting a UHF connector on there, that's going to be more difficult because the thread on a UHF connector is not 5H24, and the diameters are not right. So I personally haven't worked out a scheme for putting a UHF connector onto the stinger connector. I think about the best thing you can do, let me drop, is to install either a male or a female, probably male, connector, UHF, correction, here we go, male type N connector on the end of the stinger. Then you, with bullets, barrels, and other kinds of adapters, you adapt the type N to a UHF connector. That's what I think is the easiest way. And yes, it's going to be a great big lump of adapters at the end of the hard line. That's not necessarily bad. Weatherproofing is something you're going to have to do kind of carefully. But lots of people think that each time they put an adapter, a bullet, a barrel, an adapter from one sex connector to another, or one type connector like UHF to BNC, UHF to type N, and so on, they think that all of these adapters have got a whole lot of loss. They do not. I personally have put 700 watts from a strip line K2RIW parallel kilowatt amplifier. I put 700 watts for 10 solid minutes through a pair of UHF connectors, a male-female connection, into the antenna, ran it key down for 10 minutes, and I get a mild amount of warmth in the middle of that adapter assembly, which probably represents half a watt of loss. And half a watt of loss out of 700 watts is something like 0.01 dB or 0.03 dB, something very small. And in order to really get loss, let me drop. To really get loss in coaxial structures requires a lossy material and length. Your coaxial cable is a lossy material because in the case of RG8 cable rated for 432 as service, on 432, it's got something in the vicinity of 4.5 dB per 100 feet. It's the distributed length of the 100 feet of copper and braid that gives you the loss. If you had to make a whole lot of loss in an adapter assembly that's 2 inches long, you'd be amazed how difficult that is to do. So unless you've got the, even if you've got very yucky-looking highly tarnished copper and everything else inside of that adapter, for it to have any significant loss at your operating frequency for that short a length, stop worrying about it. So the fact that you've got a great big lump of adapters on the end of your stinger connector, don't let that make you lose any sleep, if you know what I mean, Steve. That's some of the information on putting type N's on, and I think it's the best way I can recommend for getting a UHF on there. KC2 MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Steve.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yes, once you explained that connector, it all came back to me. I remember those connectors years ago. The N connectors I've been using lately, they screw onto the actual coax cable, but I know the ones you mean with the rubber washer in it. We used to use those years ago. They were actually twin-axe connectors, and they were for computer systems, but I know the ones you mean. Very good, Dick. That clears up a lot. I'd like to start making these connectors up, and I guess once the weather breaks, I'll have to remove my antenna and do some work on it. You know, Dick, if you have time, I have another quick question also as far as coax cable.
So let me go down the list of the four guys, and then I'll come back to you, Steve. In the day that I was doing hardline, the cable that I use is 7/8 inch, correction, 3/4 inch. 3/4 inch? Yeah, 3/4 inch. And the stingers for 3/4 inch were fairly popular. They were being thrown away. Turns out that whenever they do any service on cable TV systems, they take all of the connectors that were once installed on the cable connector, on the end of the cable, and throw them into a bucket. When they get back to the stockyard, they throw away that bucket, or in some cases, they leave them around for a while. You become friendly with the guy that runs the stockyards at your local cable TV company, and you'll be amazed what you can get for almost free. They buy the cable in 5,000-foot reels, and when there's 100 feet or 200 feet left on the end of the reel, they bring the reel back to the stockyard, and quite often they get 5 or 10 of those reels with short runs on them, so to speak. They're afraid to use the short run, because if you start running that down the block, they're going to have to put an adapter in it somewhere, a splice. And they don't want to use splice because it's one more possible area of failure. You make a deal with that guy of giving him $10 or whatever for that reel with 100 feet or 200 feet on it, and sometimes you can get it for free, the price is right. And when it comes to the stinger adapters, the ones that are used, there's almost no way you can wear one of those out. In fact, it's been used once. They're afraid to reuse it. You take it apart, clean it up, take the metal chips out of it, take the dirt out of it, put it back together with some silicone grease, and in my opinion, they're worth $5 or $10 a piece, but you can get them for free, lots and lots of them. Nowadays, they're not using 7/8 correction, 3/4 anymore. Most of the cable they're using now, hardline cable, is 7/8 or 1 1/4, and they've got the appropriate stinger. So the stinger itself, for the right diameter of cable, that mating connection, once you whittle out the right amount of the foam, putting that on there with or without the coring tool, that's a beautiful mate. But the back
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Specifics, I'll tell you the Vizwar I saw you particular band. Back to you.
Yeah, Joe, you said that it works from 29 megs to 18 megs. Earlier you said it works from 10 to 20 meters. 20 meters would be 14 megs, not 18 megs. Minor little difference there. Doesn't matter. How do you broadband an antenna? That's a darn good question. I can think of ways of doing it with an elaborate structure. By elaborate structure, I mean a disc cone antenna. Because of that great big cone-shaped object down at the bottom and the disc at top, it really is a, let me call it a very fat structure. So you make structures fat as radiating structures. They tend to be a hell of a lot more broadband. But you have to go to dimensions where you're coming up to a significant number of wavelengths of fatness. In the case of a disc cone antenna operating on VHF frequencies, to make the bottom of the disc approach a half wavelength in diameter is relatively easy. On 20 meters, where the wavelength is, what, 67 feet, to go, you're not going to make a disc cone where the bottom of the disc is some good fraction of 67 feet. So that technique is almost out of the question. The other method I know of for getting broadbanding is to have multiple resonators within the structure. Let me drop. In the case of a fan dipole, you could, if you want to, make a fan dipole with a little bit of separation between all of those individual dipoles. They all come together at the center at one common point, and you could make one dipole for 80 meters, one dipole for 40, one for 20, 20, one for 15, one for 10, and so on. So by having multiple resonators, you can get a lot of individual bands included. Unfortunately, usually the multiple resonators do some funny things on the intermediate frequencies. If I had a fan dipole for 80 and 40 meters, and I fed it at a frequency some way halfway in between 80 meters and 40 meters, it would have a pretty wild standing wave ratio. So to make it truly broadband from 80 to 40 would be an extremely difficult problem. And when it comes to percentage of bandwidth, 80 to 40, I know it would be very, very difficult. To scale that up to this band where you're trying to scale from 20 meters to 10 meters, again, a 2-to-1 frequency region, to broadband it over all of that frequency, boy, that's tough. I've got no good approach. If you really wanted absolutely continuous coverage. Now, if your definition of a good broadband antenna, let me drop. If you want it to cover 10 meters, 17 meters, 15 meters, and 20 meters, four individual frequencies, you give me four resonators in there, somewhat like a 4-to-1 fan dipole, and now I can do it. On those individual frequencies, I can give you some beautiful visuar with four individual resonators on those four individual bands. But to give completely continuous coverage from 20 meters to 10 meters, I don't think I could do that. I didn't say it's impossible. I know it's damn difficult. So maybe I'm misinterpreting you. You said operate from 20 to 10. I interpreted that as continuous. Now I'm beginning to think that there were individual handbands between 20 and 10 meters that it covers. Let me pass it back to you, Joe, for some more words. W-H-O-L-Y-Y, C-2-L-A-W on the TechNet. Wait for all four beeps and then 1 or 2 seconds.
Okay, Dick, the antenna is called an Antron 99. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it or not. It's basically a firing glass type of structure, and it has two tuning rings on the bottom which allow you to tune it to a specific frequency for the best return loss, so best VSWR, lowest VSWR, at a specific frequency or band. I said it goes to 20 meters, and it does, but I didn't say I'm using it down there really adequately. It really doesn't do that. I tuned it up at 29 megahertz, and 29 meg, I show, this is without the antenna tuner and the radio engaged, so reading directly what the radio sees with the coax. I see like a 1.1 to 1. It doesn't move the meter as far as return loss. 28.3 return loss, or VSWR, goes 1.7 to 1. 24.95, 2.2 to 1. 2195, 1.9 to 1.
18.13, 2.2 to 1. But at 14.200, it's at infinity. I get full reflected power as far as the radio is concerned. So I really can't use this particular antenna down there unless I tune it lower in resonance. Back to you.
Okay, the main problem you're bringing to our attention right now is that I think you're saying the antenna is advertised, Antron 99, advertised to cover 20 meters and 10 meters and hopefully the ham bands in between 15 and 17 meters. I'm getting the impression that you can either peak it up at 29, but it only goes down to 18, or you can peak it up at 14.2, and it's not going to go to 29. Maybe it'll only go to 28. So I'm getting the impression that you can get the low end of 10 meters and the upper end of 20 meters, but as you start getting the upper end of 10 meters, you ain't going to get the lower end of 20 meters and so on. So, in other words, there's a finite amount of bandwidth you can get out of it by the way you're tuning, is my guess. And so I'm guessing there's multiple resonators in there, but with that design, it can't be stretched all the way. When you do see infinity, complete reflected power at 14.2, if it really is infinity, in other words, what you get back is only the double insertion loss of your transmission line. In that case, the antenna tuner probably cannot do it, particularly not an antenna tuner in the shack. Slim chance the antenna tuner up at the antenna itself with a real wideband, Stucci antenna tuner, you might do it. So once again, I think you're unhappy that you can't cover 20 meters and the upper end of 10 meters, but maybe you can cover 20 meters and the lower end of 10 meters. And I guess you're asking, what can you do? And I guess we got to do a little bit, you and we as a group have to do a little more investigation as to how it works and what did the manufacturer advertise. If you really look at the nitty-gritty of his spec sheet and what he claims, what does he claim is the real frequency extremes with one
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
What is his real claim with one particular tuning? If I just tuned it once, what can I really get out of it? Does the data sheet give you a hint on that one, Joe? W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-Q-L-I-W.
Well, I don't recall that because it's been many years since I put this antenna up, but I don't think I have the data sheet anymore. I might be able to find it online on the advertisement of the antenna itself. But I was more curious with the question directly that I asked of how the thing happens to work. And you said the key word, multiple resonators. The thing seems to resemble what you'd see as a low-band coaxial type of dipole, where it has an upper whip and a lower whip, because it is sectionalized. It is about 17 or 18 feet long, end-to-end, because it came in a pretty tall box, if I want to remember. You put the thing together in pieces. But the tuning range, from what I remember in the instructions, tell you, you can run it down as low as 20 meters. It will resonate down there, but you're not going to get the higher frequency performance like you'd like. Just like you said, it's going to be very lacking up at the high end of the band. So I chose to tune in 10 meters because I wanted a good antenna that works low end of 10 meters and plus 10 meter FM, because what else I had on the house was not working. It just happens to be, as a plus, it does go down to 21 megahertz, and it does go down to 18 megahertz, but doesn't go down to 14 megahertz. Back to you.
Yeah, if I was designing an antenna like that, Joe, I would start it off with a dipole-like structure, half-wave dipole-like structure, where the upper half and the lower half would be made out of, let me pick a number, three-quarter-inch diameter tubing or half-inch diameter tubing. Ordinarily, I would be feeding the outer conductor of that half-inch diameter tubing, upper half and lower half. However, if I don't feed the outer conductor of the half-inch diameter tubing, if the half-inch diameter tubing is really made in a coaxial manner, and now I've got some finite length of center conductor inside of that, and maybe I've got some chokes and inductors and other things in there, you allow me to put a tuned structure as the quasi-center conductor of the upper half dipole and the lower half dipole and feed that instead of feeding the outer. I now, with what looks like strike on the outside an ordinary halfway dipole made out of fat, half inch or three quarter inch diameter copper or aluminum tubing. In reality, there's a whole lot of other hidden resonators inside. If I'm smart enough, I can give you two or three other resonators. And so I'm guessing they're doing something like that, Joe, if you really had a chance of taking it apart. It's a hope that the Amtron 99 still exists. Therefore, if they're a reputable dealer, somewhere on the Internet there's a data sheet you can get, the instruction manual, the owner's manual. You can download it and find out what they claim. And they might even give you a schematic and tell you a little bit about the theory of operation. If it's not one of these situations where, let me drop. If it's not one of these situations where the design is not patented, they're trying to hold it close to their chest, they've got it all built inside of a potted structure, and they hope they've used some kind of potting material that you can't easily take apart without damaging the structure, and therefore reverse engineering is very difficult. If it's not one of those situations, hopefully the owner's manual gives you some hints as to what it can really do and how it does it. I think that's the next level of instruction there, Joe, but I'm slowly concluding you cannot, without the disc cone-like structure where you start approaching half wavelength and diameter of the bottom of the cone, without doing really broad things like that with a good fraction of a wavelength, quarter wave, half wave of the diameter of the cone, on HF frequencies you can't do that. The only thing you got left is multiple resonators. And if you really wanted good visual on 20 meters, 15 meters, 17 meters, and 10 meters, those are four bands, I would put four individual resonators in the antenna. And now I can definitely give you a darn good visual on the four bands. I am guessing from what you're telling me, there are not four resonators there. I think at best there are three. And therefore you're trying to stretch those three by some means into the fourth band, and you have to choose which portion of that fourth band you can get. You can't get it all. Those are some of my guesses, Joe. As you investigate further, please come back and let us know what you find. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I keep on hearing touch on probably something disconnect to the RLP. Okay. I was just sort of curious now about that. And it actually seems to work pretty good because I've made contact in Europe already on the antenna, running only 100 watts, and apparently it's radiating. If I could hear somebody at a S9, 10 over S9 type of thing, I can generally contact him back and he can generally hear me. So obviously the antenna is working. It's not like a big dummy load set up on the outside. So that takes care of that. Now, would you like to hear my comment on gun safety? It's actually a very quick comment, very controversial as far as I think, and it's also my opinion. But would you like to hear it?
Yes, I definitely want to hear it, Joe, but not now. I'm reasonably sure that John and I are going to have a discussion later on in the TechNet on the subject of gun safety. And I've got a whole lot of comments on that, some of which are controversial. John and I have been discussing it, and we've come up with a kind of a plan of action. And so there is no glamour fix on this one. So if you can stay up a little bit later, I know, though, that you've got to go to work. I think you get up at 3 in the morning. Give us a couple of sentences, Joe, because I know you can't wait. W2RYY, K2RIW, go ahead.
You're absolutely correct, and I'm going to reset the timer, and then I'll just let it fly. Okay, here's my comment, as controversial as it may sound, seem, or whatever, and it's my opinion, and I'm entitled to it. I think the only way you'll never stop violence with guns, because somebody's always going to find a way to get a hold of them one way or the other. But a way to minimize it dramatically in this country is to make it so you can't buy a handgun, you can't buy a rifle, or you can't buy a shotgun in any of the 50 states or territories without a permit. And that's not the case right now. This is my opinion. But if you think about it, if you enacted something like that, well, you're not taking away the rights of people to own a gun, but requiring them to have a permit to own a weapon, you would dramatically change things as far as gun violence is concerned. Back to you, Dick.
When it comes to new gun purchasing, you've got a beautiful technique. The problem is 300 million guns in American hands now. And the majority of the violence is happening from those. So what you're suggesting, Joe, is a good step in the right direction. It's not going to give us very much cure for where we are now. Bunch of opinions on my part. And I've got a way around that, which John and I have been discussing, and we'll hit that a little bit later. You got a good suggestion. I'm not sure it's going to give us much of a solution to the current problem, Joe. Freddie is next. WB2VBN, Victor Bravo November. Go right ahead, Freddie, with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet. Whiskey Bravo 2, Victor Bravo November. Are you there, Freddie? K2RIW. I'm going to assume Freddie got called away for a while, and I'm going to go back and call him later. Next guy on the list was Don, N2LDY. Go ahead with your question, John, K2RIW.
Okay, yes, thanks, Dick. Good evening to everyone. Happy holidays to everyone. My question to the net, or to you, Dick, was, I'm installing a mobile radio in the car, and I want to put a fuse in the ground line and a fuse in the power line. Is that at all necessary to have a fuse in both the hot lead and the neutral lead, the return lead, or can you just get away with one fuse?
You probably said it, and I may have missed it, Don. You're probably talking about a mobile installation. Is that true, Don? Go ahead.
I did say that in the beginning. I'm installing a mobile in my car, and I'm just curious, is it really necessary to have a fuse in both the hot and the neutral?
Necessary on the neutral, probably not. However, if you want to be belt and suspenders, double dot sure and safe, I think it is recommended that you put one in the negative lead. I'll admit that I didn't do it. I think the philosophy on that is that if anything goes wrong with the wiring of the automobile, such that a whole lot of current flows between the return lead and the battery, that wire that you added in order to wire your radio into that automobile was wire that's not necessarily rated for fusible current and fireproofing and all that kind of jazz. If something goes wrong with the wiring in the car, and let me pick a number, 50 amperes flows through that neutral lead, because an error in the wiring of the car takes place where when you're running the starter motor, which can draw 100 amperes, and the real grounding of the car becomes defective, and now that 100 amperes tries to flow from the battery through your return lead into the grounding of your radio, and that completes the circuit so that the starter motor can run. Now you could create a fire in that wiring if there isn't that fuse. So I'll admit that scenario is an extremely rare scenario, but it could happen. So belt and suspenders, do it. If you don't do it, I don't think anything bad is going to happen. I've run mobile rigs in my automobile now for 30 years. I've never done it, and I know I'm taking a little bit of a chance. That's the way I see it, Don. N2LDY, K2RIW.
WB2ZSA.
And, I take it you want to, when you install the fuses in the car, you want to put the fuse as close to the battery as you can?
Absolutely. As close to the battery as you can, because the most suspicious wiring in that car is the wires that you added. I mean, the way you bring that wire through the grommet of the firewall, it could always, short to ground at that point. Something goes wrong there. The radio itself, in many cases, creates a ground by way of the coaxial cable coming out of the radio. Even if you've got the whole radio sitting in a plastic holding device of some kind, by way of the coaxial cable going to the antenna, and in many cases the antenna is going through some kind of mount that grabs onto the sheet metal of the car for the counterpoise of the antenna, you could in some circumstances have lots of current flowing through negative lead into your car radio, Yes, your ham radio through that coaxial cable and ultimately into the grounding of the antenna. And you could be trying to put 100 amperes through that when you run the solder motor. So because the wiring of that car that's new and suspicious, the wires that you added, as far as the automobile manufacturer is concerned and as far as your insurance company is concerned, that's the suspicious wiring. And the best way to make that wiring safe is to fuse as close as you can get to the battery itself. ZSE, WB2ZSE, if you've got a comment on this exact subject, start off with your name, sir, and go right ahead. K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, hi, Dick.
Yeah, actually, I do. You're basically 100% correct. It's probably not a good idea to do that for that reason, and I've had that happen to a customer's radio and vehicle. As well as the fact that if you mechanically mount the radio in the car, odds are you're going to also get a ground through it that way as well. So it's not a particularly good idea because your radio becomes the fuse. Also, people have the mistaken idea that the fuse is to save the radio in case you have a problem with it. It's shorten it. You don't really burn too much of it out. It's actually so you don't start a fire in the car.
Very fine, Steve. So where I guess that the major problem is, does your brand new, suspicious, non-factory installed wiring, you have violated many of the warranties and everything else as far as the automobile manufacturer is concerned, and maybe even your insurance company. You've added extraneous wiring. You've taken that beautiful waterproof grommet that goes to the firewall, you violated it, and you stuck wires through it. Unless you're real smart in the way you did it, your wire is suspicious wiring. So those fuses on both the red and the black lead at the battery is to protect your automobile from fire of excessive current flowing through your wire. And the secondary thing you're protecting is your radio. The primary thing you're protecting is your automobile. That's my guesses. Steve confirmed it. He's done those kind of installations. I think we know most of the story now, Don. N2LDY. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much, Dick. Hopefully that cleared it up for me, and hopefully a lot of other people, that newer people to the hobby that might be installing radios now.
Good luck with that installation, Don. And as you complete it, come back and tell us how well it works. Give us a feedback. Let's see if Freddie, I think it was Freddie, is back. I think it was WB2 Victor Bravo November. Freddie, are you there? K2RIW in the TechNet. I do know that Freddie, when I was talking to him directly, he did disappear mysteriously. So I guess there's a slim possibility his battery ran down, his antenna became disconnected, or he got called away. We'll call him again a little bit later. One last call. If anybody tried to sign in and I didn't get to you, or now you decided you want to sign in, we've got a couple of minutes before we start the mailbag. I should have mentioned that mailbag is going to come before the space report. So anybody else who wants to sign in with a question or a comment, give me a call, letters, and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N, Paul.
Paul recognized. And one last call. Anyone else besides Paul? Okay, quite possibly Paul really has a question. You're allowed to do that, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW. You got it, Paul.
Okay. Yeah, question and comment. This has to do with these induction lights. I don't know if you've seen these things, but I live in the town of Islip, and now they're installing them in all these street lights all over everywhere. When I first heard about this, you know, the plan on doing this, I was thinking about it because they do transmit a radio frequency, and but then I just said about three or four nights ago, they put them in, you know, all the way on my block, and they're really quite good. I mean, they really do love TV. But I checked it out, and I didn't find any interference you know, I checked all my bands and all, so I was kind of surprised. But I went over close to the light with an AM radio, off-tuned it, and boy, it blows it away when those lights are on, you know, 5-10 feet away. Wow. I don't know. Do you know anything about these induction lights? It's amazing. Read up a little bit on how they work. Thank you, there.
There's a possibility that very weak voice I just heard was Freddy, and you're just barely making it. You may have to move to another location if that was you, Freddy. I will come back to you in a minute. You keep calling it induction light. I'm not familiar with that set of words, Paul. I know that some of the extremely high-efficiency street lights that have been used in the past are called high-pressure, low-pressure, sodium. They're not incandescent, or are they? Anyhow, there's various kinds of sodium-like lamps that are require a fancy ultraviolet shield, and they do give lots of lumens per watt. I don't think streetlights yet have gotten to the point where they can be using light-emitting diodes. I don't think they're using what we call a compact fluorescent. So I think street lighting is still either incandescent or vapor-like. So the word induction. Give us a few more words on where that word induction came from, what it really means, because I think I'm hearing it for the first time, but maybe I'm in the dark ages on this one, Paul. WS2N? K2RIW, I'll wait for the two beeps and then 1 or 2 seconds.
K2AMZ with a comment on induction light.
Okay, 1 sec, let me see if I have it. Okay, very good. Yeah, another station I just heard in there. These things are round things, I guess about 6 inches in diameter. And it's a glass tube that they don't have any elements going into it. There's no contact. You know, it's just a hermetically sealed light. And what you have is there's two 180 degrees apart. It narrows. The tube gets narrower. I'd say overall maybe, I don't know, it looks like about 1.25 inches in diameter. Whole round tube. And there's a ferrite metal around the surrounding the part of the tube, you know, 180 degrees, and then they've got a coil around it, so it's creating a magnetic field. And they take the 110 volts, they put it through a really transmitter, and they bring it up to. I read on the internet it's between 2.65 megahertz and 13.6 meg, so it could be in any one of our hand bands on the HF band, 80 meters. I checked it all out. I'm not getting any interference, and I'm about 50 feet away from the light. So it works out okay. So it's generating like a radio frequency, but creating a magnetic field, and it excites the mercury inside. The bulb itself is kind of like a fluorescent bulb, and then the mercury atoms, when they go back from their excited state, they give off photons and ultraviolet, and it's the phosphorus, and you wind up with the light. It's really cool. I mean, you could save up to like 55-80% of the electric of your electric bill on this. ISLIP is one of the first people involved. Huntington's getting a little involved in it now too. Back to you, Dick.
82AMZ with a comment.
Yeah, we got you, Mike. And make sure you reset the machine and KD2AMZ. So smart guys in Seacliff, tell us what they know about induction lighting. You got it, Mike.
Thank you, Dick. Yes, when I was down in Pennsylvania, I installed induction lighting. It's used in outdoor fixtures. My particular fixtures were tunnel fixtures. What makes them unique is they are basically an electrode-less lamp, and they actually look like fluorescent tubes. They're very long-lasting, and they're instant strike. If the power goes out, not like a metal halide lamp, where you have to restrike. It takes about 20 minutes. These start up right away. They're relatively new fixtures, but yes, they are starting to be used in outdoor commercial lighting. And yes, they do use LEDs now in outdoor commercial lighting too, you know, parking lots and things like that. Laughs and Giggles, just go to and Google it and you'll find out. But it's just as the name implies, it's an induction lamp where it's like a fluorescent tube, but instead of being hardwired to the electrodes, it's via induction. And they're actually great lamps, very, very bright, and they're very efficient, KD2AMZ.
Well, you called it a conductorless lamp. I see that as one huge advantage, Mike, because it is a contamination that takes place because of the current concentration around the conductors, the two ends of a usual fluorescent tube. You'll notice that the fluorescent tubes tend to develop a bunch of black contaminated area at the two ends near the electrodes. And if you can eliminate the electrodes, I see a huge advantage. Now you've got nothing but pure mercury, maybe a couple of other inert gases in there, just the right amount of argon or whatever, at just the right pressure in there with the fluorescent. And I can see how that can become more efficient, less failure mechanisms, as long as you can now feed it in an inductive manner. There is, let me drop. There's a kind of electric stove that many people are now using where, as long as you got the right kind of copper bottom pots, I'm going to call them, the pot itself goes in the vicinity of this induction coil that's buried below the insulated section of the range. You can put your hand on that range and it runs ice cold, even though you've got the burner turned up full blast. Put the pot there. The pot recognizes the rapidly changing magnetic field. You now got induction heating of the copper, which is not, by the way, not too different from your gun-type solder iron. So you put a very small voltage at very high current by way of the induction function into the bottom copper section of that pot, and it gets hot. And so I can see how with the right kind of a circuit, so the pot is the secondary, the coil below is the primary, and it's kind of a transformer. And so by this induction heating lamp, you've got a coil somewhere in there, which is the primary, probably being fed at some quasi-RF frequency, maybe 100 kc, and maybe it's a half a megacycle. And the secondary is the turn of the fluorescent tube with no contacts inside. It instantly turns on that mercury vapor, and out comes light. There's a bunch of guesses on my part, and from what you know, is that the principle, approximate principle of operation of what you installed, Mike? Any idea what frequency it runs at? And what kind of wattages can you buy of these things? The ones you use in your home probably are nowhere near as many watts as they use for street lighting, but I can see how that principle can work very well. And if they were, let me drop. If they were smart enough to put the right kind of a shield on the lamp, so that it only directs its light straight down onto the road and none of it into the eyes of the driver, and hopefully none of it up in the air where it contributes to flare light, which makes the astronomer-oriented people unhappy. If they've done a good design job on that nice little ring and with the right kind of a shield around it, I can see that can be a very nice, modern, high-efficiency light that'll make the dark sky people happy. So tell us a few more words on what kind of wattage you think these are good for, and are they claiming long life also, and what kind of frequency they're running at, if you happen to know, Mike. KD2AMZ, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Yes, this is KD2AMZ. And again, these are electrode-less lamps, and the energy to the lamp, which is basically a fluorescent tube, is induced via electromagnetic fields. The ones that I had installed were in the 400-watt. They were 400-watt units. The beauty of this 400-watt unit, it put out the same amount of lumens as twice the wattage of a typical metal halide lamp. So they're very efficient. They throw off a lot of light. their long life because the electrodes is the part that burns out, as you said, in a typical fluorescent tube. It uses, again, a higher energy, just like you said. I don't know the frequency, but I do know from personal experience they are extremely bright. When they were lit up in my installation, you could not look at them. They were so bright. It lit up the installation in the dark to 30 foot candles at 30 feet beneath the lamp was about 30 foot candles, which is quite bright. So it's an extremely efficient light. They do use them now. This is KD2AMZ. And just Google it and you'll find out a lot of information about it, but it is used in commercial. They're a little on the expensive side, but they work great. This is KD2AMZ.
VE3ZTZ recognized. We'll get back to you in a second. And by the way, ZTZ, your audio is very low, but I'm hearing you with the earphones I'm wearing. So you might have to eat that microphone on the next transmission. And so, boy, that sounds awfully good. And although they're a little bit expensive, if they've got a long enough light to them, it's a good investment. So the real cost of ownership over the whole life of the lamp could be a hell of a lot less, even though the initial investment is higher. Sounds like a good way to go, Mike. Let me turn it back to you quick, Mike, first. To your knowledge, Mike, are they being used for street lights? I'm reasonably sure the answer is yes, because I think Paul told us that. And to your knowledge, have the really progressive communities, have 1% of those communities already installed them as street lights? Or are there certain places like Pennsylvania where all of them are already there? What's your guess as to how much penetration into the required street lighting these induction lights have already taken place, Steve? That question, Mike. KD2AMZ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yes, do I?
Recognize station. Yes, I'll make it short and sweet because there's another breaking station out there. They were not very relatively used by, let's say, the state level, but on the federal level, they love them because of the maintenance cycle. There practically is no maintenance on these things. They last forever. And the energy savings. So this is more of a federal thing. I don't know about the local state, local, you know, road utilities, but on a federal level, they love it.
Okay, Paul was the guy from the S2N who just broke in. And before I send it back to Paul, the guy who asked the original question, VE3ZTZ, he wanted to, that's Scott, I think it is. Scott, I think you have some information on induction lighting, and maybe you guys in Canada have been using them for years, and we're slowly catching on. VE3ZTZ, give us some more audio. K2LAW on the TechNet. You've got it, Scott.
I did adjust the mic, Dean. How is the copy now?
Before you were 10 dB low, now you're 3 dB low of what I would like to hear. Scott, go ahead.
This is the highest setting. How's that?
That's just about right, and maybe you're getting right to the threshold of getting a little bit of clipping. So back off just a skosh from there and go right ahead, Scott.
Merry Christmas and happy holidays to everybody, first of all. We're not using these induction ones up here, but we do have a sports park, which is lit for baseball in the evening and soccer games and things like that for nighttime. And they're using these new type of lamps called sulfur lamps. And because sulfur is extremely corrosive, you cannot put metal contacts into any sort of traditional bulb or filamenting to make the sulfur, the little blob of pure sulfur, ignite. So what they do is they nestle it, a small megatron tube, exactly like in your microwave oven, and the microwaves excite the pure sulfur dot. And this is apparently the most efficient lighting out there. And these things are extremely bright. I'm told they're the brightest light per watt, per aluminum per watt available.